Hello and welcome to The Creighton Crowbar. It's the 24th of September and this is episode 11. My name's Tom Francis and with me is...
Josh Davis.
Graham Smith. Tom Senior.
And the big news lately, I think, probably is the Steam thing or the Valve thing. I think of it as a Steam thing now. Steam has eclipsed Valve in my mind as a company, even though they're not a company. Which you will know and we don't. We know one third of it because we're recording this on Tuesday. And it'll go out on Friday, and Friday is when we think they're going to announce the final bit of it, right?
Yeah.
So the bit that's been announced so far is Steam OS. What do you think about that?
I think, I mean, as me, it bears no real significance whatsoever. Like, I don't, like, as a gamer, it doesn't really make much difference to me whether Steam on my TV box on like the computer I've got hooked up to my TV, it doesn't make a difference whether it's running within a Steam OS or whether it's just running as a piece of software on Windows. But I, from reading about it on the Valve website that's advertising this thing, it sounds really good for developers in terms of, you know, if it's true what they say about it making things quicker and easier.
So it's Linux based. It's an operating system. They haven't really said, I mean, I guess it runs on PCs, but they say this ominous term, living room machines, which it will run on. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they're implying that sort of like certain like smart TVs or something might be able to run it, but I don't know if they're just saying like, or if it's just Linux, then that's just PCs, right?
Well, yeah. I guess it becomes like, is the Ouya a PC? Cause
right.
Ouya is just a little box that you can quite easily install stuff on. And I think it's based on an Android operating system, isn't it, by default? But you can really easily rip that off and install other things on it. So presumably you could buy an Ouya, plug it into your TV, and then put SteamOS on there, and then use it to stream games from your game PC elsewhere in the house and play them on your TV.
It does feel, at the moment, really like the hardware part of this is conspicuously absent. Like, everyone's expecting them to announce a Steam box, and the little icons they have on the page make it look like they're probably going to announce a box that contains this OS.
Yeah.
Like, the icon for the OS is an O, and then the next icon for tomorrow is O in a box, or O in little brackets.
Yeah.
But we don't really know. But I think even if they don't do something themselves, there needs to be a launch of a thing that is reasonably priced that you can put in your living room that will run games.
Yeah.
And also, the main thing I want to know is, the coolest feature to me is that you can stream from a PC elsewhere in your house to this box. So even if the box isn't good enough to run games, or if developers haven't added support for SteamOS to their games, you can still play them from whatever PC you're currently using to play them. And that could be really cool, but I want to know, like, I have a Raspberry Pi. Can that do it?
Yeah.
Because it can watch videos, and if that's all it takes, then great. But it needs some kind of, like, okay, this sounds like a cool concept. Now tell me, what do I do to make this happen in my house?
I wonder if the idea seems to be that they're smashing open the console market and injecting the kind of level of hardware competition that you see in the PC market.
Yeah.
Which seems like a fairly sensible thing to do. It's pretty good. And it does that both, as you say, by allowing different hardware makers to make their own devices, which will run the Steam OS, but also by streaming. So you don't even need a particularly powerful thing underneath your TV.
Yeah.
But there's been some kind of fear that the idea of Steam OS is that it's going to eclipse Windows, and that it does actually say in their bump that you can install it on your own PC or your own desktop. But I don't think you would. I mean, unless you're really into, the convenience, the reason the PC is great is because it's a really multi-purpose device and you can switch between sensible things and silly games at the drop of a hat. And I don't want to boot out of Windows and boot back into SteamOS to do that stuff. That doesn't seem like a realistic scenario.
No.
Unless it's like super fast somehow. If it's like a really, really efficient way of running some games, I can imagine booting into it to play like Saints Row 4 doesn't run that well on my PC. Saints Row, what is it, 5? 4?
4.
And neither did Saints Row 3, and there are just a couple of things that are like not quite fast enough yet to run them, and if they did run better in another OS, I could boot into it. And if, you know, presumably it'll have a web browser that will work fairly well, like Steam has one built in, but it's not that great at the moment. But if it's all like native to the OS, I think that would be a serviceable thing to use the internet on. And I think maybe most of us are now using most of our stuff just on the internet. Like,
it's true,
actual downloaded applications, or actually installed applications, are less important now to most people.
As a Photoshop user, I think it doesn't have much order, but...
The thing with the little icons with the countdown and the set is that the circle within the square brackets is not in the center of the square brackets, which is the only thing that gives me pause to think that maybe it's not about a hardware box. Like, why is the circle to the left? Why is
that's where the power switch will be on the Steam Box. I actually have no idea whether it will be that. And we're going to look really stupid either way now.
Yeah.
I suppose either possibility.
I think it will be hardware. And then the third little icon is a circle plus another circle, which seems to suggest it's going to be how those machines will network with one another. What do we think the likelihood of that being some sort of cloud computing thing or peer-to-peer distribution thing? Or?
Gabe Newell has said that they're sort of like three levels of computing, where like the current one we have is like the processing power is in the machine you're playing on and it's physically right in front of you and that's a direct thing. Then the next one up is you have a thin client architecture box in your house that is receiving a video signal from the powerful PC and is showing it to you in your house, and that's over a local network. And he said before that he thought that was a good thing, like that works. And then he said that actual cloud computing, where all the processing is done outside of your house in a server farm, he thinks the connectivity just isn't good enough for that to actually work well.
Well, not in the UK, anyway. By ages.
Yeah, and he thinks it's just like...
I can't stream radio in this house sometimes.
I think it's something clever that I can't remember about... It wasn't just the fact that broadband isn't fast enough, there's some more fundamental problem that means it just won't get sold in the foreseeable future.
Is that latency, you mean? Just...
Well, yes, perhaps, but in some clever sense that I don't really understand.
Control latency has always been a big issue with things like OnLive, where it's about the signal getting back to the computer that's miles away and then returning the input from that. It's always generated lag.
Because you remember that interview I did years and years ago where you mentioned three surprises.
Yeah.
And so long ago, I can't remember which ones we had now, whether we've had three. But... one of the questions I asked in the interview is, what are you thinking about these days? Because he says he's always thinking about like 5-10 years in the future. And he said that one of the things he was thinking about was thin client architecture, which is a thing where you have a box that isn't going to process the games themselves, but is going to be the way you interact with the boxes.
Mm. He did also once say that he was interested in motion control. So
yeah, I guess that like that's the, you know, that's why he's thinking about stuff way ahead in the future and not actually doing it, because he's, you know, considering all the possibilities that might happen and might not happen. I really agree with him on, he said that, in a different interview, the mouse and keyboard is kind of a long-lasting control thing that has been around for a long time and has been, you know, hasn't been fully surpassed yet. And that, he thinks touch screens are not that. They will come and go the way motion controls did. And, that there might be something in the future that is better than mouse and keyboard, but that touch isn't it. I definitely fucking agree with that now that I have an iPhone and I'm trying to play games that I don't. It just doesn't fucking work. It's not good enough.
If you have to obscure the thing you're looking at with your finger in order to control it, that's not the ultimate kind of control paradigm, I think.
I've been playing with motion controls this past week because I borrowed an Oculus Rift and borrowed a Razer Hydra.
Oh yeah.
Which
How
is
was that?
The kind of, well, the Razer Hydra is like, kind of like, you know, like you got the Wii Nunchuck where you plug it into the Wiimote. It's like two Nunchuck components. So you're holding like an analog stick in each hand, and there's like an orb that you set on your desk in front of you that kind of tracks your positions in space. And then people have, Valve actually supported it, I think, officially with Portal 2.
Yeah.
And then I'm not sure if it's Valve or if it's just been retrofitted into like Half-Life 2 and Team Fortress 2 and that kind of thing. And so playing that with the Oculus Rift, so you're looking around with your head, and I, like there's the Tuscany demo for the Oculus Rift, which is just like it's a Unity thing, which is just inside a Tuscan villa that you can walk around, and there's some stuff you can pick up and that kind of thing, and there's like a basketball there in the house, and you can, using the Razer Hydra, sat at my desk in the office, bending over to the floor to pick up an invisible ball with my virtual reality headset on, hoping that I'm not about to smack my head off my desk, and then throwing the ball sitting in the middle of the office. It was just deeply weird experiences, and I just kept having this mind-body disconnect between I'm sat down, but I'm standing up, but I'm picking up a ball, but I'm not picking up a ball, but I'm looking to the right, but I'm not really looking to the right, and now my chair is misaligned to where the desk is, and I hope I don't knock over my bottle of Pepsi Max in a minute while I'm throwing this chair into a fire. And I just kept feeling sick within about 20 minutes. And I've played on the Oculus Rift a couple of times before and not had that problem.
So you actually think it's the motion control aspect?
Well, I think that's not helping. I think like the increasing the sense of the disconnect between my physical body in the game and the physical body in the real world, I think is giving me a greater amount of brain confusion. but it's definitely cool, and like I don't think that touchscreens or motion control are going to take over from a keyboard and mouse, but I still think there is a place for motion control, which is, you know, there's interesting things you can do with it. Like that was a compelling experience, just bending over to pick up a ball that was on the ground between my feet.
Did anyone see the video of Alone?
No.
It's a Oculus Rift game where you play a man sitting in his lounge playing a game on his home console, on his TV. So you're in a virtual room with a TV in it that's quite big, and on the TV is a game that you're playing, and you use like a PlayStation controller to play it. And so the controller is just controlling the game itself, and then all your head is doing is looking around the room in which you're playing this game. But it's a horror game. And so as you're walking around, you keep finding creepy notes about like things that happened in this house. Stuff like, you know, the person writing the notes is going through a sort of, going crazy type experience where he keeps hearing and seeing things. And so he hears like children crying and stuff. And then you hear children crying like from behind you. And then eventually it starts to mess with like things actually happening in the house around you that are also connecting to what you're seeing on the screen in game. Like at one point the screen switches channel, and it switches channel to a view of the lounge, so you're being seen through a camera that's in your house somewhere, but as you're watching through the camera, you can see a dark shadow moving through the room that you can't see in real life, so you're kind of frantically looking around with the Oculus Rift to kind of see it in real life, but every time you look back at the screen, it's there, and every time you look away, it's not. And that seems really cool. But the guy playing it says that when he's played horror games before with the Oculus Rift, and if something freaks him out, if he hears like a horrible noise behind him or something, he instinctively takes the Oculus Rift off to look behind him in real life to see, like, is that thing really there? And, of course it isn't. And he said in this game, he doesn't get that urge because something's happening in his virtual room. So he just looked around in the game. Like, that's his version of reality now. When he needs to really check if something's really there, he looks around in the game, which is just terrifying.
There's an Oculus Rift Jam recently that was won by someone who claims to have solved the nausea problem. And the way they did it was by simply putting the player in an utterly abstract world in which there was no concept of down or up.
Or it might undermine some of the advantages of having an Oculus Rift.
Yeah, quite. But without the frame of reference.
Just play Tetris. It's totally 2D.
It was this kind of weird file structure where there were these hovering orbs that were connected by these sinewy tendons, and you were moving through this world, 3D space, going between the gaps. But the idea of not having a gravity or conventional rooms or objects that your mind recognizes as behaving in a certain way frees you up to, you know, just enjoy the environment without, you know, feeling that disconnect between reality and what you're seeing, because it is so abstract and removed from your everyday experience.
Is Oculus Rift going to come with headphones? Because how is this guy achieving that surround sound? Is he just really well set up in his room?
He's got like a gaming headset on.
And the Oculus Rift?
Yeah. I think I presume they designed it in such a way that you can have headphones on at the same time.
Yeah.
What I was doing in the office.
It must be quite a tight fit. How many more things can you fit on your head?
If you're wearing glasses underneath as well.
Yeah.
Graham said it was quite heavy.
I got really hot. Like, having a CRT monitor strapped to my balls for a long period of times, I would just like, not just my face would be hot, but my whole body would get hot. Like I was having a fever response almost to this tight thing squeezing my head.
God, the newspapers are going to have a field day with this, aren't they?
It was similar to the horror game you just mentioned. I can't remember what this thing's called, so I'm going to imagine it's called Oculus GIF, because that's what I would call it. But it's an Oculus game where you're sat on a couch, much like I am right now, and on the couch next to you are two other people, and then there's just a giant TV screen, and it's just looping GIFs of different themes, and then you can bring up like a menu to say, I want to see cat GIFs, I want to see animated cartoon GIFs, and that kind of thing. And it's just kind of this quite dark room, and you can just barely make out the silhouettes of the virtual people on either side of you, and when you look over to them, they look back at you, and it's just like this flashing images up on the screen of like changing rapidly through different types of GIF.
Isn't one of your fellow watchers an orangutan or something?
It was a kind of like horrible dystopic future of, but kind of interesting.
Yeah.
To come back to the Steam thing, like, that, Steam doesn't have any way to play a game while it's still downloading at the moment.
Mm.
Is that right?
You're downloading games.
Yeah, so, well, rather than having to download a game all the way to 100% before you start playing, you have to do that, don't you?
Yeah, I think so.
It pauses downloads, if that's what you mean, when you start a game.
No, it's about playing the game you are downloading.
Oh, I see. Yeah, right, sorry.
Because the Steam beta that I was on before Steam launched, you could do that. You could,
really?
Yeah, you could start downloading Half-Life 1, and you would get, because this was before Half-Life 2 even came out, you could start downloading Half-Life 1, and about 30% of the way through it, you could start playing it. Because it had downloaded the engine and enough textures in the first levels in order to do it. And I imagine it's simply a infrastructural problem that stops them from being able to do that, because they're the server load they would need.
I think it's down more to the fact that every developer would have to code a way of delivering things in the right order in order to enable it. So Blizzard do this, for example, Diablo 3, if you download that.
Yeah, they're really good at it.
And it works really, really well. But I think that's because Blizzard have built their file structures in a way that lets them do that, whereas third-party guys putting stuff on Steam, it would work for Half-Life if Valve were trying to do it, but if it was the Saints Row guys, they might not necessarily.
Yeah, they would have to make it specifically for that.
Precisely, yeah.
I imagine it just got difficult to support. Like, I imagine it just introduces loads and loads of potential problems that don't come up every time, but might come up in certain situations. Like if it's not downloading fast enough, for example.
Mm.
And they probably realized what you're saying, Tom, which is that, like, it's not going to be that valuable to other developers because not everyone's going to support it because they have to change everything about how the whole engine works in order to support it properly.
I was just trying to think.
And so they probably thought, like, it's not worth investing in it because only we can use it.
Just trying to think what other things you could do with some sort of peer-to-peer infrastructure if you think that broadband internet connections aren't fast enough yet to make cloud computing. If you're going to build a vast network of small machines all running SteamOS, what could they be doing when they're talking to each other that would be powerful?
Be more of a recommendation network or something like that, or a way of kind of delivering recommendations to each other, or an advanced friends network, an advanced version of the friends features. That
you had an interesting idea that you mentioned on Twitter, Tom, where you said that they mentioned Steam Workshop a lot in this update, and you're speculating they might just have a Steam Workshop for free software that runs on SteamOS. Like SteamOS is the game, and you have a Steam Workshop just for that operating system where anyone can put software on it and people can rate it and discover it.
Hmm.
I feel like that, even if that's not part of this announcement, I think they're going to do that.
Eventually. I think the thing is,
they already sell software on Steam.
About making it Linux as well, is the fact that it is an extremely flexible OS that anyone could go in and change. And they kind of implied in their announcement the way they described SteamOS as it being this thing that is kind of yours, and it's yours to mold or change and tweak bits of. So I can imagine someone might mod an Oculus Rift interface into the way that Steam is presented, and then you could activate that and install that, and that's how SteamOS could run for you. Or someone else could, you know, change it completely or add things to the overlay or mod it in many different ways.
I'm really glad that one of the only companies who really supported modding and really saw it as a good thing and really kind of thought, like, you know, people make free stuff for each other in our game. That's good. I'm really glad one of those people actually became, like, one of the superpowers in gaming. Because all the other superpowers fucking hate it and want to shut down people doing anything to their game, and want to make you always online and make sure you never modify their files in any way and never get to have any participation except exactly what they mandate. It's cool that Steam and Valve are, A, in favour of that, and B, powerful enough to actually do something about it. And the thing I find most surprising is just that they even want to bother with this shit. Like, if I was them, with the amount of money they're making, I'd just be like, fucking sort it now. Let's just rest on our laurels for a few years. And just make, like, I'd just be making fun, small games. I'd be making, like, you know, if I was in charge of Valve and had that many cool, productive people working for me, we'd be churning out, like, 20 games a year. Just be a relentless stream of, like, cool, interesting projects, and then whichever ones people liked best would develop further.
I think the thing with Valve is that they're interested in growing the entire audience of PC gaming. Like they want to grow the entire market. And they say it's because that will benefit everyone, and it will. But it will mainly benefit them because they have such a stake in the market with Steam. Mm-hmm. And so by growing the entire market, they just grow Steam and they grow their business. So it does kind of make sense.
What you need to understand, though, is that PC gaming doesn't exist.
No, don't say that. Oh, don't bring that up.
Yeah, that was a comment made presumably in a rash moment by Ben Kuchera on Twitter in response to this the Steam announcement. Yes. I'm quite sure where he was going with that. I think his idea was that because Minecraft is really big and the PC game is dominated by a few really big top sellers, which are quite insular. So Minecraft players don't necessarily play LOL. Mm. LOL players don't necessarily play StarCraft. That it's actually a series of big games. So Minecraft players aren't PC gamers. They are Minecraft gamers. And I think that's kind of true of all gaming platforms, really.
FIFA, Call of Duty.
They're definitely Halo gamers, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, but also, if that were the case anyway, and I think PC gaming is probably more diverse than any other platform as it is, but if it was the case, I don't see that invalidates it as some kind
it's
of
just a platform where people play games on.
He said it was just Steam, free-to-play, and niche.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, no, you haven't got this, have you?
Yeah, there's only... How many uniques a month does PCGamer.com get now?
More than him, maybe. I suspect. Yeah.
Ah.
Shall we, speaking of PC gaming, let's talk about GTA 5.
Yeah.
Because we kind of realised that as we're talking about what we've been playing, we've all been playing GTA 5, and sometimes to the exclusion of all else. And I think the question of, you guys talked about it last week when I wasn't here. I don't think any of you played it at that point,
no.
Is that true?
No, I don't think, we talked about...
You didn't talk about how good it is anyway.
Oh yeah, in fact, I explicitly said that I had pre-ordered the game.
Oh yeah.
Because I was feeling left out and then cancelled that pre-order 5 minutes later.
What happened since then, Greg?
It turns out that the day that podcast went up, so last Friday, I just went to a store and I bought it. I caved. And I don't regret that decision at all.
Excellent. I thought, yeah, I just think that even though it's not a PC game yet, the question of whether it's any good is relevant to PC gamers because it's worth knowing, hey, should I be looking forward to this coming to PC or should I be angry that it hasn't come to PC yet?
And that's how we justify the fact that we haven't played anything else this past week.
Some of us have played some things on PC. But it just seems crazy not to talk about it. We've all played it and we all have opinions on it. Yeah. And it's an interesting topic.
Exciting.
I'm looking forward to PC gamers fixing all the problems with it. Not that there are many. I think it's a great game, but there's still quite a lots of little kind of GTA traditional rough edges that they seem to delight in that I quite likely having smoothed out.
Yeah,
I'm liking it more than I thought it would. I thought I was going to really hate it because I've always hated the writing in GTA games, and people specifically complain about the writing in this one like more so than previously. So I thought, oh god, if it's worse than fucking GTA 4 or any of the previous ones, then I'm going to have a rough time. I don't hate it so far, the writing. There's some horrible, cliches and stereotypes and stuff, but the characters haven't been immediately utterly despicable. They've just been a bit stupid and just, you know, the main problem with the writing is just that they have a conversation where, like, two people just hate each other and then they just go on a mission together at the end of it. And, like, your main character, the first main character, Franklin, is a kind of vaguely sensible kid who's, like, embroiled with the wrong element, but kind of knows that gang life is bullshit and that you shouldn't get involved in that stuff. And that's really undermines all of the stitching of the plot to the game, because every conversation he has is like, no, I'm not involved in that shit. It's bullshit.
Oh, don't right.
And then that just ends and then you're on the mission. Well, I have to do it because the game's just making me do it. So they still don't know how to write that stuff, but,
Yeah, they do. The tradition in GTA games is that you end up working for people who are utterly grotesque, doing things that you really resent. But there's no, and you kill millions of people during this process, and you can't turn around and just shoot these dudes in the head and walk away.
It's not just GTA, it's just all Rockstar games. Red Dead Redemption has it as
well. That's true, yeah.
Snake also is winning grave robbers, and you just spend the whole time berating them for being terrible, terrible people, and then go get your shovel and start digging.
Yeah, it's not done too much of that in GTA 5. I actually think this is probably, there is at least one instance where it becomes extremely egregious. That seems to have become a flashpoint amongst people who've played it. Don't know how you feel about that moment, but we can't really spoil it.
The controversial...
Controversial scene.
Interesting.
I haven't got to that yet, so I have no opinion.
Okay. We should.
But the best thing about it, in terms of, like... Well, the setting is great. I jumped on a train and took the train out of the city into the countryside, and at the moment when I came out of the tunnel and looked back at the city and looked at the hills, I just, what the fuck? Jesus Christ, this is insane.
It is amazing.
To realize how just massive it is and how just it's just very weird to leave a city. Like, you could leave cities in San Andreas, but they never had that kind of, they weren't, like, the city wasn't stunning that you started in, and it probably was quite big in terms of, like, geometry, but there wasn't that moment of looking back at it and thinking, whoa, look at that fucking huge place, and, you know, the game is bigger than that huge place, which is what I got with this. And the other best thing about it is that you can, while in midair, press B to ragdoll. So you can just throw your limp body at anything in the game. And that's like 50% of what I do. I just throw my limp body at things. And just like, when you're told to get in your car at the start of a mission, I throw my limp body at it in such a way that my skull hits the windshield and smashes the windshield in like a spray of blood and broken glass. And then flop like awkwardly off it and smack into the pavement as the NPC who's kind of patiently waiting for me to start driving just watches.
You've not really signed up to the thug life, have you?
Neither has my character, apparently. Both of the characters I've got so far, one of them hasn't yet got involved in gang life too badly and doesn't want to, and the other one already has and is sick of it and hates it and doesn't want to get back into it. So
yeah,
it's just going nowhere. We're just going to sit here and have a happy retirement.
It's weird. It kind of almost has more of a moral dimension than previous GTA games do.
Most of them have been about someone, like San Andreas was about a kid trying to go straight, wasn't it? Like he was a...
Yeah, they're always kind of reluctant psychopaths, yeah, killing loads and loads of people. But
San Andreas was a guy who kind of had gone straight, and now he was coming home because his mum had died. So he was coming home to bury his mum and then get sucked back into the terrible thing which he had escaped years prior.
But I find in GTA 5, as I'm just tootling about, I don't find myself causing that much carnage. I don't really find myself... I find myself... Because it's quite a pleasant challenge to actually not drive badly. So I don't tend to crash into things. It's probably the first game where I've not really been inspired to just cause mayhem in a GTA game, which I've not been inspired to cause mayhem.
Yeah, Senator Graham, you mentioned like a car blowing up and blowing up another car with the explosion, and I realised, oh yeah, that's the thing that used to happen in GTA.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't blown up a single thing in this game yet.
Yeah, it almost feels like the city is interesting enough, there's plenty enough things for you to do that it almost doesn't need the firefights. Enjoyable though they are, and, it would be hypocritical of me to suggest that they should get rid of them because I like shooting men, unfortunately. but it does. I haven't found myself just only doing that. I've been driving dirt bikes up mountains and stuff.
Yeah, I think it maintains enough integrity as a narrative and as a place that you don't want to destroy it. Like if you feel bad, I feel bad when I hit someone with my car because there is a sense of. Like, the anime, like, they still look like GTA people, but there's enough of a sense of life to it that I feel like I'm ruining the experience by destroying it rather than it being just this sociopathic playground for me to tinker with.
That's kind of what Trevor's for, though. So, like, it takes a long time to unlock that guy, but when you do, he drives around in a huge, poorly handling truck, and he has the worst driving skill out of anyone, and it's almost mechanically encouraging you to go a bit wide on those corners and just kind of cut, you know, this drives this frustrating default vehicle, which is this big red truck, and you accidentally run people over, which is what he does, and then after a while you just go, eh, fuck it. I'm a psychopathic sociopath, and off we go on a ridiculous rampage.
I haven't reached that point yet. Like, I do like that they've kind of given players a character with which they can use for that, so it doesn't break the narrative consistency of Michael or Franklin if you do want to go nuts, but I'm not like Trevor, so I don't really want to play that role.
I apparently am.
I found there's lots of side missions which are now, like, the level of interaction you can have with that world is much more subtle than it has been in previous GTA games. So they're able to do side missions which actually feel kind of more like, you could imagine them building an LA Noir style game within that game. Like, it has the facilities to support that. I don't know if they're going to do that, but there are hints around the environment that there's some kind of murder mystery plot that you can unravel. I don't understand how you initiate that, really. I've just found scraps of it. But some of the side missions get you to go and do chores for people. There's one where you go and you have to obtain a series of celebrity knickknacks, sometimes forcibly, from people. But the means by which you do that involves going to a place and searching an area where you have to roam around to find the object in question. And I don't know, did you guys find this? It just feels like that's something that could substitute. It's a kind of rich enough interaction that it could substitute to some extent for the usual shooting and driving stuff that you do in GTA games.
I find LA, the whole structure of the city, more interesting than New York or Liberty City. Just simply because I find the way that it's not a grid, and there aren't these alleyways that are just making predictable connections between the big grid roads. But you can go to these back alleys that are shaped interestingly, and they're quite interesting places to explore. Often there's people there, or there are cars there, and there are things going on. And it's a place, much more explorable place for me than Liberty City ever was, I think. But then, I don't know, Graham, you prefer New York love a bit of New York.
I love Los Santos as a place, and I think it's a better designed kind of place for the game than Liberty City was, mm-hmm. but I prefer the atmosphere of, because just in real life, I prefer New York to Los Angeles. Like, mm-hmm. and
there's not enough rain in Los Santos. Like, yeah, that's the rain is so beautiful in GTA 4.
That's exactly what I said, in fact. And like the kind of thunderstorms, the kind of tropical storms you get in Los Santos from time to time.
That's fucking amazing.
When
that first happens.
But yeah. I do kind of miss the blowing newspapers and rain of GTA 4.
I disagree with you that it's like Los Santos is a better... is necessarily entirely better for the game. Obviously, the scope of those games has increased, so they're doing a lot more with it than they did in GTA 4. But in terms of just the road network, like, you'll pull up to an intersection, and that intersection will span the entire screen. And I have no idea which way traffic's going on this intersection. Cars could come out of anywhere. And when you're going at 90 miles per hour and you're not going to stop at a red light, you know, it feels like it's very difficult to read. And maybe this is just Los Angeles, I don't know, but... I find it very difficult to parse that city for kind of obvious driving routes.
I think because I'm more maniacal with my driving generally. I don't necessarily care if there's going to be, I'm going to get blindsided because, you know, I take my bullet time to get around it. But I enjoy those giant sweeping causeways and those huge kind of, you know, the motorways that kind of bend over the city. And you can kind of very quickly glide onto those and, you know, just getting around that place is an absolute pleasure. Going up, it's the elevation, the hills that you have in that place. They've modelled cars so that they struggle getting uphill if you're in a kind of a low rev car, and then they'll absolutely fly downhill. Like, going downhill on a bike is fucking amazing because you just gain so much acceleration from just going down those enormous hills. And that, just getting around the place feels interesting and different and exciting in a way that Liberty City didn't.
Hills, they've done a really good job with hills.
Yeah, they have, haven't they? Yeah.
The cliche in video games is the one, epitomized by Skyrim, where you're walking upright and you're kind of slowly bunny hopping Whereas in this, when you try and walk up something that's too steep for you, you basically just kind of keel over backwards and ragdoll down it. And it looks fucking brilliant.
They've made a bunch of really smart structural changes, which I think really help it mechanically and narratively. So one of which is that the whole world is open to you from the start rather than gating the three islands in the same way.
They still did that in GTA 4, didn't they?
Yeah. And the other thing is just being able to switch between the three characters. And so, like, I find that there's a point in a GTA game after about an hour and a half, 2 hours, where I've done a couple of missions and I've tooled around a little bit and I've done a side thing. And then I'm just kind of, I feel like I'm done. Like, I feel like I've played a session of the game at that point. And although there's lots elsewhere to go do in the world, I'm just not that inspired to do it. And just being able to switch to another character at that point. It's like...
You can play three times as long. For 6 hours without realising that you played too much.
Yeah, and even though the activities I'm then doing with the other characters are just, again, I'm just driving around and shooting stuff.
But your hair's
just
different.
It sticks my brain a little bit and I become inspired again. It's the same thing I have with my Kindle, where, like, when I used to read actual books, I would get to a point where I read a few chapters and I'd be like, okay, I've had enough now, and I put the book down and I'd go do a completely different activity. Whereas with my Kindle, I'll read a few chapters of a book and then think, oh, I'm kind of done now, and then I'll just pick up another book, I'll just switch over to something else that's also there. And it's just that kind of the kind of multitasking thing you have when you're using a computer and you've got 26 tabs open in Chrome and you're flicking between them all, paying no attention to any of them.
Feels a lot less artificial than previous GTA games, where you'd have a map which was bristling with different things for your character to do, and it always felt like you were plate spinning, basically, because you had so many different narratives that you'd be bouncing between. It never felt like it would make sense for a person to be jumping between these different, completely conflicting storylines, whereas it makes a lot of sense for different characters to have their own lives.
And it's been at its best so far when the three main characters have interacted, and they're quite enjoying the dynamic. Mm. Yeah, the heists especially. But the way that Trevor and Michael just drive each other into crime is just brilliant. And totally makes sense for those characters as well. Franklin, as this relatively sensible member in that, is quite interesting. Obviously, I've only played about how many hours? 6 or 7 hours, maybe? Mm. In to get the gang together. But I can't wait to see where they go with their relationships and stuff.
It's like TV shows have this great sense of ensemble drama, where you watch something like Game of Thrones, say, and you've got people at opposite ends of that world, and you kind of, you wonder idly what it will be like if, oh, what if that character over there was to meet this character over there, how would they interact? And it's exciting when those things happen. And Grand Theft Auto actually has that feeling of this is an ensemble drama. And so anytime Trevor and Michael or Michael and Franklin meet up, it feels like the pace picks up in the story.
It's because you switch between them as well. So, as in previous GTA games, you would, in a single mission, you'd probably, there'd be lots of prompts for you to go over here and do this, whereas now you just, it says, switch to Trevor because you need to do something, and so you switch to Trevor, and suddenly you're in a different place doing a different objective, and it makes the missions feel really pacey and exciting, and each character has their own kind of roles to play.
And it kind of brings GTA closer to, like, GTA's always riffed so heavily on cinema and cinema. It actually brings it so much closer to that, like, it's flicking from the guy who's rappelling down the building to the guy who's the sniper. It's very kind of cinematic, it's like, but I mean.
But it's better than cinema, because you get a sense of, there is an aspect in which it's better than cinema, because you get a sense of space. And, one of the things that annoys me in cinema is when, directors coyly break the actual environment. So they'll jump cut between two characters, and you won't really, and the Bourne films are quite bad for this. Like, lots and lots of cuts, and it means that they can put characters in different places and have them running from one area to another without actually having to think about how that would work spatially.
Yeah.
Whereas in GTA, not only do you switch between characters, but the camera pulls out towards that character, and you get an immediate sense of where you are in relation to them. And I don't know, that for some reason, that's much more, particularly with the kind of, the setting of a heist, somehow that really makes sense. Like, it's all about planning and your interrelation and your, different roles within a crew.
Mm.
And it's that, just having that relationship with people spatially really kind of makes that perfect.
Ocean's 11 thing of, they use split screen throughout the heist at the end of that, of like flicking between, you know, Brad Pitt's over here doing this thing, George Clooney's over there doing this thing. That's really satisfying to actually be in control of each of those roles in the game. But the other thing is, like, the overall character arcs are progressing much faster than they would have in previous GTA games. And like with GTA 4, like I think Vice City was the only Grand Theft Auto game I'd ever completed. And with Grand Theft Auto 4, I stopped shortly after I unlocked the second island. And at that point, I'd been playing the game for like 20 hours. And the reason I always stop is that I don't understand why the character doesn't just stop. Like, Nico Bellic is this kind of sad man that doesn't want to get into crime, but he gets sucked into it because of his cousin, and everything kind of goes horribly wrong, and it's depressing, and he ruins his cousin's life, and he ruins his own life, and gets a bit of money, but then just keeps going anyway. Like, you got the money, you solved the problems, move away, move somewhere else, use the money, go to university, I don't know, buy a house. Like, you can be walking around in that game and have millions in your bank account, and still Nico is just glumly doing rote missions for assholes he hates. Whereas in Grand Theft Auto 5, although they're making a game of comparative length, they can move those three characters' storylines along much faster. They don't have to make you work for 25 hours before you get a better house for Franklin.
Oh, yeah, that's all up front, really, which is great.
You get, like, after 6 or 7 hours. And at that point, it sells the benefit of crime to me. Like, with Nico, he just worked for 25... Like, I played the game for 25 hours.
You're the people Christopher Hitchens is worried about.
But it's just like, you reach a point quite early on where Franklin just has shitloads of money, and if he's concerned about this life of crime, he could just back out and go do whatever he wants at that point, because he's quite well off. He's got more money than I've ever earned in my life in his bank account. But then he gets material rewards that don't eat into that bank account, and I understand the allure at that point of, like, I didn't do very much, and now look where I live. And it's basically, you've got a house.
It's the most extraordinary fucking house as well. Like, it's a proper mansion on the edge of the hill, and a swimming pool that you look out across the whole of fucking...
Yeah, they know the that thing you were saying a moment ago, Tom, about when you rode out of the city on the train and you get this kind of sweeping vista of the city behind you. They know the value of what they've created in that, because there are multiple points in the storyline where they go... Ta-da! And they show you this, like, sweeping vista, like, even a character who drives, and there's, like, a little mission to just park at the side of the road, and it's just, like, a scenery viewing point, and he just kind of speaks to the city and shakes his fist at it for a little bit, just so they can show you, look at this cool fucking place we built.
After that, shortly after the controversial scene, there is probably, which I really had problems with, I was quite angry about, but then went back to it the next day, fought my way through it, then shortly after that, there's probably one of my favourite scenes in video games, which is just the kind of most rewarding Vista moment in any video game ever. And it's got an amazing soundtrack. It was just like pressing like the endorphins injection button. It was amazing. But yeah, I do think there's still a morally questionable game in lots of ways. I think that people have been saying it's a misogynistic game. Probably is, actually, I think. There's no real redeeming quality to any female character in it whatsoever, as far as I can tell.
They're almost absent. It's kind of strange. Yeah. Like, they appear very occasionally, you know, like, a ridicule, then vanish stage left. Then there's just no women in the game, apart from, unless you go to the beachfront, in which case you see a load of girls with bikinis, like, 90% of the people.
Well, actually, if you idle with Trevor, he ogles women. It cuts to a cinematic camera and he just looks at women's asses and tits as they walk past.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
This is classy. But I mean, maybe that's the character, so, you know.
That's okay then!
I don't know, man. I'm only 30% of the way through according to the percentage marker, so maybe there's redeeming stuff later on, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
I don't understand why that tone is necessary. Like, the things that we're excitedly talking about right now are the world and the beauty of it as a place and how fun it is to explore and the fun missions and the action and all that kind of thing. But there's plenty of films which contain all those things, but aren't 13-year-old South Park, worst episode of South Park ever level satire, nihilistic, don't care about anything, just resolutely cynical, misanthropic, misogynistic, hate-filled. Like, why can't it be more like Ocean's 11? Why can't it be fun and peppy? Why can't George Clooney be the charming main character who's sad about his life, but, you know, has charm rather than just this world full of assholes?
I don't necessarily think that the solution to its potential misogyny is to have a playable female character. Like, Rockstar wanted to tell a story about these characters, and it's kind of up to the author which characters they choose to tell a story about. But I think they could, since they do have female characters in the wings, it could do a better job of not just shitting on them relentlessly, I think. And obviously there's the violence aspect of it, which comes to a head in the controversial scene.
Yeah. Interesting.
But, yeah.
Speaking of heists.
Oh, yes.
We weren't just now, but at some point we did. The PC game I've been playing is Monaco. And I kind of bounced off Monaco originally. I didn't really, we played it together, didn't we? It was me, you, Martin, Kim.
Yeah.
And was it you, Graham?
Yeah.
Played it as a four, and we didn't really know what the hell was going on, did we? And it was just kind of baffling, and we'd just get caught all the time on everything, just constantly being chased by guards, and it really just became the runaway from guards game, without really knowing what the hell any of the flashy colours and weird symbols meant on the map. And so since then I've been playing it with my friend Nika, is a two-player co-op, and going through the whole campaign quite methodically. And we were also terrible at it at first, and we still are in many, many ways. But I now know roughly what most of the symbols mean, and I know some of the mechanics, and it is possible to do some missions almost completely stealthily. We, I think, almost always get caught at some point on each objective. But I think there's been like once or twice we've got in and out and like got the objective without any alarms going off or any guards being alerted. And the rest of the time, we get most of the way to the objective without anything going off. And then something, you know, some challenge we're doing just screws up. Like, we don't manage to step through a laser at the right time, or we can't find a way to turn off that laser and also knock out that guard at the same time. So we just think, fuck it. I'm like, I'm 5 centimeters from the objective. I'm going to grab it and then rush out of the building. And that's quite fun. That doesn't actually ruin it. When people are catching you all the time, when it's just constantly like every few steps you take, a guard sees you and or a laser trips and people are chasing you, that gets really boring because the game isn't that good at dealing with it. It's basically, it's got a bunch of very artificial mechanics in that the guards can't follow you up ladders or to a different floor. So you just have to run up a ladder or to a different floor. And then the guards cannot follow you even if they know you went there, even if they see you climb the ladder. And you just have to totally depend on that. If that mechanic wasn't in there, the game would be almost impossible. So you have to depend on those artificial things. But if that only happens at the end of the mission when you're running out of the building anyway, it doesn't feel weird that the guards don't follow you to the next floor when you sprint down there. And it kind of adds it adds the madcap chase sequence to your heist movie. And I really enjoy that. And so I'm starting to like it a lot more. And so then when you guys were around, the other day, I was like, come on, play Monaco, I understand it, man. Now it's brilliant. It's actually much better than I thought.
That didn't work out well.
$316 for this 4-player. And it was just like the old days. Just, everyone's getting caught all of the time, and I'm trying to explain, no, but it was more fun before, I don't know why.
Yeah, I think if you have time to pause and think things through in that game, it works. But if there's four of you, there's very little opportunity for that.
Yeah, you have to all be very coordinated, I think. And it's just... There's so many weird things about it. One of the reasons I bounced off it, because I didn't really understand what was going on, but that normally wouldn't put me off, like, a cool-looking heist game, because I fucking love heists, and I'm willing to, you know, learn game mechanics and figure things out. But the reason I nearly never went back to it was just that I didn't trust the game design, because it seemed bad. Like, the classes you're choosing between, you're looking at them, and there's, like, the cleaner... The cleaner can knock out enemies who haven't seen him yet. He can knock out enemies who haven't seen him yet. Nobody else can. He's the one who can defeat the enemies. The other people can't defeat the enemies. That's one of the classes. Next one, pickpocket. He has a monkey who can pick up gold from further away. He can pick up gold from further away than the other classes. Then there's the locksmith who can pick locks a bit faster than the other classes. So everyone can pick locks. He can pick locks a bit faster. And it just seemed like these, like, there are just shit classes and then there are brilliant classes. And if you're going to have, like, early on there are only four, eventually you unlock eight. But when you start out as four, so if you're playing with four players, well, two of you have to be shit classes. Two of you just have to do stupid rubbish jobs that make no sense. And then the lookout has a good ability. She can see guards through walls when she's sneaking. But A, she has to hold down sneak all the time to do that, which is just annoying. It's just a mechanical problem. And B, it benefits all of the team equally. So she has no advantage. Once she's on the team, she doesn't have to do anything. Mm. She could just... stay at the start and just hold down sneak, and she would be of as much use to the rest of the team as when she follows them. So she has no actual ability that kind of, that's an active thing that she can use. And so the class design just seems really weird to me. And it still kind of does. But we're now at the stage where playing with two players, there are enough cool classes that we think, oh shit, I really wish we could take this one as well, but we can't because there's only two of us. And, it's definitely a game that doesn't, I think the class design is weird, and I think it doesn't adapt well to differing numbers of players. I think it's really, it might not be intentionally designed for this, but I think probably three players is the best, unless you have a really brilliantly coordinated team of four. But with two, you have, we usually play with like a hacker and a cleaner. So I'm the cleaner and I knock people out. She's the hacker and she takes out electronics. And most missions have serious laser security and serious guards guarding everything. And if you can't take out both of those, then you're going to have to trigger one of those. You're going to get caught by the guards or get caught by their lasers. And then you're going to be in trouble. And then you can still get the objective. It's still possible. You just have to muddle through it and there'll just be alarms and it'll be annoying. Whereas if we had, like, if you have a hacker and a cleaner, then you can get past those most of the time and it's difficult, but it's doable. If we had a lookout as well, then that would be great because then we could, you know, that's the next kind of level. Or if we had a mole as well, then he can find alternate solutions by burrowing through walls. But then if you have four players, you don't really need all of them strictly, or it's kind of, it's a bit too good if you are coordinated, because then you have all of the abilities you could possibly need. And if you have one player, I've tried it in single player, and I just think it's a bad game in single player. I really dislike it, because it just, there are just so many obstacles that you just can't get past with this class. Like, this class can't get past that laser. Just can't be done. You're gonna have to set off the alarm. And you, if you die, then you get to play as one of the other classes, so technically you have like eight lives, because you can play as all of the classes in turn. But that's not a good way to play. Like, it's just a co-op game where you can't cooperate in any way, and you just have to run up against challenges that you can't defeat and wait until you're the right class to do it.
I found that even when I worked out what was happening up on screen in the visual mess of the game, and even when we were being kind of coordinated a little bit, or at least we weren't instantly triggering the guards in every situation, there was no individual interaction with the game I personally could have which was satisfying. So even the cleaner, who is one of the useful classes, to knock out the guards, you just kind of walk up to them and then walk into them, and every interaction in the game is just walking into a thing and a little what's it, like a timer bar comes up and counts down, and that's not that satisfying to me, and the guard behavior isn't interesting enough to make that a satisfying challenge. You just kind of crouch down and sneak up behind them, push into them, and there's no hiding the bodies or worry about guards finding them really or anything like that. And so, like, I've played as the cleaner and I had that problem. I played as the mole and I found that I wasn't really that useful, and It sounds really cool being able to tunnel through the walls, but it can't require that class because, like you say, if you don't have that person, then the mission's kind of useless. And the locksmith or whatever, I would just kind of run over to a door and be like, all right, guys, I can do this later. Oh, you've already done it.
Visually, I just kind of filled with a sense of despair. And like, I mean, it makes a really nice music visualizer, I think. But as a game, it's just unpausable because it should explain it. Initially, each level looks like a schematic of a building, like it's just a plan. But it's a really kind of low contrast plan in which the symbology is slightly weird.
Dark grey and black.
Which isn't great. And then as your character moves through it, sight lines are drawn and the kind of the world illuminates based on the exact cone of vision that he has. And other characters' cone of visions are also plotted on your screen. And if you have the lookout... If the lookout is crouching, suddenly your vision blossoms even more. So the effect of that is that if you're playing with lots of players, the screen is just strobing continuously with all these kind of sweeping coloured beams all over the place. It's completely chaotic. And I think maybe that's the intention, but it just means that ultimately it becomes very difficult to corral a team of four players because it's just so visually incoherent and you end up playing Pac-Man.
It's a cool visual effect to have something go from a blueprint to real rendering as you move past it and see that kind of sweep. It's like a sort of, it's like a beam of light, only it's doing more than illuminating and it's changing the nature of the thing. But it does just mean that everything you're looking at is changing art styles 2 times a second. And so I think if the game was all just rendered in real looking stuff and it was just dark where you can't see and illuminated where you can see, like most games, it would be much better. It wouldn't be as fancy. It wouldn't be as sort of like, wouldn't have the same wow factor when you first play it, but it would be much easier to understand and everyone would just get on better with it, I think.
It's the thing is they've gone for a stylized art style, not just in the schematics, but also in the real world that you're illuminating. So the characters aren't, if you just saw one of the kind of sprites of the characters, you would not identify that as a person in the game. You'd think, is that a pot plant? I don't know.
Yeah. I like them though. I like this.
It's nice, but it's not very readable. That's the problem.
It's the strange thing about it is that it has realistic, well, not realistic, but a kind of, you know, representative people and environment and some quite lushly rendered bits of the world, and then just big diamond lumps of gold that you pick up. And the objective in every case, you're told in the story what it is you've got to get a passport. And then when you get to it, it's a giant gold trophy. And it's like, I don't know whether you'd call it an icon or whether it's a physical object, but there is nothing else. It's just the trophy. And it's even called the trophy when you're playing it. So to get to the trophy, pick up the trophy and then leave. So like when you're in the game, for some reason there's just a few elements of it, they decide to abstract out and break the fantasy and say, no, no, you're told in the story you're going for a passport. It's not. It's a giant gold trophy. When you walk into it, it explodes in a shower of gold, and then you start leaking gold as you're running away. It's like so abstract in some ways, and so kind of...
It's one of the classes a hacker.
Yeah.
Okay, so that the hacker, when they walk up to a terminal, and then you see the hacks as bright green blobs that just flow down wires that cut across corridors and cut across other characters, are just like they're brighter than anything else on the map. And that was, for me, I was just watching for most of the time. That was the most confusing thing I've ever seen.
They're color coded as well, so it's the color of whoever hacks the computer, because the hacker can hack computers and power outlets and everyone else can hack computers. So like I'm the cleaner, when I hack a computer the hack is pink. And so if Nika's hacked some, like, 3 power outlets and I've hacked 2 computers, there's 2 pink blobs and 4 blobs. And they're just, they trace, it's incredibly sophisticated and interesting and weird. Like, your hacks are pets. So you hack, if you want to take out a laser grid 3 rooms down, you hack a computer in, like, the admin room, and then you've got a hack pet, and it will try and follow you, but it can only move down electrical wires. So there's an electrical grid of wires in the level that you can't see normally, but when a hack is there, it's following them, and it'll try and stay close to you, and then when there's like an electronic device near you, it'll try and shut it down. So it's this really strange concept of like electronic pets moving through the wires that you can't see.
But then, that's the thing, that this desperately feels like a game that needs to be played across 4 different screens, where only the hacker can see that, because that is the most confusing thing ever to everyone else on the screen at the same time.
Part of the problem was, when we were playing on separate screens co-op over the internet, was that someone would hack a thing and the lasers would go off, and then wasn't clear how long they would be off for before they would come
and
on.
And if that person moves, the hack might move away to follow them.
Yeah, and so like 2 people would go through a tripwire that had just been turned off, and the third person would go, oh, it's off, and they would try and walk through it and it would come back on and it would intersect them, and the alarms would go off for everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does make me want to watch a version of Ocean's 11 which George Clooney has a monkey that can pick up gold from somewhere <by the way.
laughs> Talking about co-op, you've been playing co-op game with yourself, haven't you, Tom?
I have, yeah.
Seamless.
Yeah, me, one controller and two characters in Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, which is a game by Starbreeze, or what's left of Starbreeze after a lot of them left to form Machine Games, I think. Starbreeze made Chronicles of Riddick games, which are astonishingly violent but very good first-person shooters, kind of stealth games. And this is utterly unlike everything that the studio has ever made before. So it's this charming fantasy tale of two sons, and their father has been struck down by an illness, serious illness, and they have to travel through the world looking for a cure. And it's a puzzle game in which no one speaks English. Everyone speaks a kind of version of Simlish. So all of the personality of your two brothers is inferred by their interactions with the environment. And all you have to do is requires a controller, and you have to walk up to an object and press each character's corresponding action button to interact with objects in the environment. So if, there's an older brother and there's a younger brother, and, for example, the older brother can swim, the younger brother is terrified of water, for storyline reasons that you'll find out quite quickly as soon as you start playing. So you have to walk the older brother into the water and then have the younger brother come in and grab onto his brother's back, and then you use your older brother to ferry them across. Charmingly, they're both on... You have to play the controller, and the bigger brother is on the left stick, and the younger brother is on the right stick, and the older brother... the interaction button is the left trigger, and the older and the younger brother interaction button is on the right trigger, if you see what I mean. So you get this really interesting situation where you're trying to corral two characters around the environment at all times, and they have to help each other across puzzles in the environment. So there are, like, there are certain switches where they both have to be grabbing them and pushing them down, and there are certain points where they'll be tied to each other and they have to swing each other across gaps and that kind of thing. But that's all kind of moot because the puzzles are never challenging, but it's just about this journey through this extraordinary, beautiful kind of, I don't know how to describe the world really. It's kind of a fantasy. It's kind of feels like a Germanic fantasy. So you've got trolls. Everyone's living in small villages, and there are old troll creatures, and kind of there are mountainous regions, and then you'll traverse into a really weird dark section where you're being pursued by wolves through the forest. And it's more about moving through environments and moving from different set pieces than actually being challenged in any mechanical way.
That sounds good. That sounds like what I want.
It's really beautiful. It's really, really beautiful. And it's kind of hard to really pin down why. It's just the way it immerses you in that place, and the way that your characters interact with things around them. It just gives them such a sense of personality and character. So the younger brother, they go up to an animal, the older brother might pick up a cat, and the cat tries to claw their face, and he goes, "Oh no, this is, oh, blah, blah, blah," and then
that's his personality.
Yeah, that's his personality. Cats hate him. And then the younger brother will go up and he'll put it on his shoulder, and the cat will start purring, and, you know, that's good with animals. And it delivers so many of these little moments that you soon get a subliminal sketch of what those two people are like. And it does this so elegantly and so quietly and without fuss that it's just this beautiful hypnotic thing that draws you in and into its world and into its characters.
Those characters are so well delineated through such tiny kind of little gestures. I remember I only played the preview, so I was only playing the opening sequence, which is set in this autumnal kind of idyll. You're walking through this village. If you go up to this lady who's sweeping her steps, the older brother will take her broom and help her sweep, whereas the younger brother will balance the broom on the end of his hand kind of playfully until she kind of shoos him away. And you can, like, as the younger brother might take a ball off a girl and throw it down a well, yeah. Whereas the older brother will shoot a hoop or something like that. And yeah, it's nice. But the younger kid is obviously mischievous, but at the same time, he's also got kind of like some kind of artistic sensitivity because he likes animals and he's talented at music and things like that. But all of this is just drawn without any speech whatsoever. It's really well done.
And there are these, obviously these beautiful idyllic landscapes constantly, and it does this beautiful job of kind of coiling them back on themselves. So it'll always give you, the camera moves very subtly to give you a sense of where you're going all the time. So you'll be moving across a ridge, and the camera will kind of angle to show you the top of a mountain, and that's where you're going, and you don't realise it yet. It's just gently showing it to you. And the entire world is peppered with benches that you sit down, and every time you sit down at a bench, it's showing you something that you're going to come to, or it's showing you something that somewhere you've already been. So right. It creates this constant loop of, this real sense of moving through the space, coherent space from environment to environment, without feeling like there's levels, like juddering level divides between each section. And that's just a really beautifully, subtly worked effect.
Have you completed it yet?
No, about halfway through, but I've heard there's a very effective ending.
So there might still be a bit where you get arrested and sent into an underground prison where you have to stab people to get
this might happen.
To escape.
This might happen.
And they get to like a giant servo mech to destroy your
I think the older brother will go in the servo mech and the younger one will do the stabbing, basically.
It's game directed by a film director, isn't it? Joseph Farrez. Have you seen any of his films?
I've not seen any of his films.
I met him, and he's, as of all the people I've met, while being a journalist, he's by far the most charismatic human being, I think. I think he might be a vampire.
Does he glimmer you?
Yeah, totally under a spell, but amazing kind of tirade against the traditional publishing industry and how it crushes creativity and how this was just a kind of thing that they did off their own backs and independence of artistic spirit and so on, and it's like, God, I follow this guy in hell.
Did you say that in your next interview question?
I
follow you into hell. Will you take me there?
Yeah, I think most everybody who came out of that interview room was kind of crying. So,
it's nice that a film director has made a game that seems to use interaction.
Now you mention it, there's some very directorial kind of techniques used. So there's one of my favourite moments is where you encounter it, this quite early on, you encounter a friendly troll who helps you out, and his job is to help you up difficult terrain, so he'll pick you up and throw you up to different ledges. And you'll always see the troll traversing around in the background and kind of moving across. And there's one pit where you're going over a mountaintop, and you can't see the troll because he has to take a different route. But the way they've angled the sun, the way they've angled the entire level, you see the silhouette of him clambering across. You always know where he is, and you've always got this sense of where you are in relation to him, and that relationship is there, and it's kind of building it as you're going across. And it's just beautiful and quietly done, and I just think everyone should play it just to sink into it and enjoy it. It's only about 4 or 5 hours long, I think.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't go back to do films. It's keeping him in games.
We need to hold that time, yeah.
I'm glad also they didn't try and implement any kind of keyboard support, because obviously that dual stick thing is so fundamental to it.
Absolutely.
You could have one brother on the mouse and one on the keyboard. One's point and click and the other one's just...
Yeah.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Let's do them.
Questions from questions.
Duncan asks, "Oh, good crate and crawl barricaders. My question on this fine eve is, what games do you enjoy playing in LAN? Preferably any interesting and or free games instead of the usual shitters."
I voted for this question, didn't I? Because I had an answer to it, and now I can't remember what the answer was. Diablo, which isn't the usual shooter, but that's awesome. And
Diablo 2, or because you can't play Diablo 3 in LAN without an internet connection.
You've probably got an internet connection there, right?
He doesn't specify, but yeah, most of the time.
Diablo 2 is the one that we played masses on LAN, though. Like, we had a proper, like, I think we just had like a week where we brought PCs to a friend's house and played Diablo 2 just every day and went through the whole game, and that was fucking awesome.
Wasn't your obsession with SubCom facilitated by LAN?
That was going to be mine, yeah. Supreme Commander Forge Alliance, when we did that in the office, the six of us against 2 AI, I think it was. That was incredible. And the game, the complexity and the scale of it means it really benefits from being in the same room as the people you're playing with, so you can call out to them what you're doing.
Yeah.
My other thing would have been Artemis Spaceship Simulator, which simulates the bridge of a Star Trek-style spaceship where each person takes on a particular role, like the comms officer or the science officer or the weapons officer, and then you have a UI in the game which is specific to the role that you're playing, and then it's completely dependent on you talking out loud in the real world to the other people on your ship, including your captain, who has the view screen and is telling you what to do.
Does it specify how many people?
No.
Because Splinter Cell Chaos Theory Co-op is one of the best LAN things I've played. There's just two players, but it's all about like lowering each other on ropes and like coordinating takedowns so that you both wait outside two different doors to the same place with like two terrorists watching TV, and then like bash in at the same time and run in and smack them in the side of the head. And there's stuff like defusing bombs where you both have to cut the right wire at the right time, and the right wire is changing, and you can only see it in thermal vision. And for some reason, you can't cut it while you're in thermal vision. So you have to like look at it in thermal vision and see which one it is. And then when you're ready to go, you have to switch out of thermal vision and very quickly cut that same wire. But you need to do it at the same time as your friend. So you need to say, okay, I've got my wire. Have you got your wire? Have you got your wire? Have you got your wire? Yes, I've got mine. No, I lost mine. I lost mine. I can't do it. It's fucking awesome.
We played Rainbow Six Vegas and Vegas 2 in the office quite a lot, and
they are shooters, but they're pretty great.
Yeah,
they're not the usual shooters.
The narrative co-op part of it, the co-op missions were pretty shit, but Terrorist Hunt was great.
Yeah.
What was the other thing?
Terrorist Hunt's like, it gives you a, it's almost like a multiplayer map, but it's full of, terrorists that it spawns in random locations, so it's different every time you play it. And so you, like, every time you go into a room, even if you play this map loads of times, you don't know if, you know, there's going to be one on your left or whatever. So it's like really, really tense every time you play it. There's a map in that called Murder Town, which is great in first place. And then there's a dark variants of certain maps. So there's like the same map, but it's at night, so it's harder. And there's Murder Town Dark. And Murder Town Dark is the hardest map in the game. It's insane.
The only place where real estate prices haven't risen in the last decade.
Satire.
Hypocy asks, although doesn't really ask, Hypocy says, "Hello patrons, I'm guessing that war games are the most common inadvertent teachers, and thus it was for me. For most of my life, most forms of combat had made sense, but gunline combat, in particular the American Civil War, seemed absurd. I was thinking that they stood in a line in the open in front of guns because they were all idiots. Sid Meier's Gettysburg changed all that by, firstly, making clear that everyone got behind stuff whenever possible, and secondly, by forcing me into the limits of pre-radio warfighting and smoothbore range and reload times. Interestingly, the layer of numerical abstraction on turn-based implementation of the same era meant they didn't touch my misconceptions in the way that switching between rotation, volley, and at-will fire did in Gettysburg." That's him responding to a conversation we had, I think, questions from questions last episode, where we were talking about what things had you learned from games, or how could you design good educational games. And I think pretty much all the examples we had came from war games.
Yeah, it's true. Particularly the thing about smoothbore rifles. Like, games have trained me to imagine that bullets basically go where I want them to,
precisely.
Which is not really the case. In fact, it's the case in movies as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, handguns are actually spectacularly inaccurate past design. Yeah. Much closer range than you'd imagine.
I really like... have you seen The Assassination of Jesse James?
No.
By the coward Robert Ford is its full title. But in that, it's one of the few westerns in which guns are given their accurate level of inaccuracy.
I've always pointed.
And so these kind of two people are having a shootout in a room pretty much the same size as this, which is small. And they're kind of walking towards each other, firing continuously, and only manage to kind of hit each other with the last shot. Because the bullets just don't go straight. But yeah, that would be shit in the game, probably. Yeah. In a shooter anyway.
Teach you something.
Yeah.
was that Half-Life 2 mod, which does it, which gives you I don't know what a smooth bore rifle is, but it has those American Civil War rifles where you fire a bullet and then you've got to put the bullet in and then the gunpowder in and then pump out with a, it's a Half-Life 2 mod.
Is it set in Half-Life 2 or is
no,
it
it's set in like just fields.
Because I was thinking like S mod, have you ever played that?
Oh yeah.
It's just a set of weapons for Half-Life. Actually, it does much more than that. Actually, it adds new enemies and stuff, but it's still just Half-Life 2, so it's the same campaign, but you have like the banana bomb from Worms 2 and like lasers and all this crazy shit.
S-Mod was great.
A pair of scissors is one of the weapons. Yeah. You just throw it.
S-Mod, doesn't it add fears, kind of jump kick and bullet time? And so you can
it's awesome, awesome slow-mo. Yeah. And you can kick. Loads of like improvised and weird weapons. I think there is like a really old-fashioned rifle. Like maybe, might even be an M1 carbine from World War One.
Yeah. Okay. So do you Red Orchestra games simulate weapon inaccuracy?
I don't know how accurate their inaccurate weapons are. So, I mean, they kind of do though, yeah.
I only ever play on action mode because I'm a wuss.
I've played quite a lot of realism mode for not the recent expansion, but just Red Orchestra 2. And yeah, those weapons are pretty inaccurate and they become more inaccurate as you get shit scared. You know, your character becomes suppressed and panicked when bullets are pinging around and your hands are shaking. And if you're using a long-range weapon, then you've got to dial in the scope to the distance away the person is to compensate bullet for drop, bullet drop yeah. over time and stuff like that.
And what have you learned as a result of that?
War is cool!
War sucks.
Bullets fall.
Henrik, aka Oddjob from Sweden, asks, "Hello, Critians and Crobarians. What's your favourite multiplayer map? My favourite is DoD Hell that came with a version of the Day of Defeat mod. Having sniper wars on that map was wonderful. Me and my friends are right now planning to get 6 to 8 friends together and play it again over VPN."
I liked it's quite an unusual one, perhaps, but Gulf of Oman for Battlefield 2. Because it was the demo map. So, like, demo map always the one you play the most, particularly with the pre-release demo, which I think is what it had. So I played that map, like, 100 times before I ever played the full game. And it's a coastal map in, is it Iraq? A Middle Eastern country. So it's dusty and fairly typical, like, game, modern video game setting. With a aircraft carrier off the coast that's the US base, and then the, what's their name for, like, I think they just call them enemy forces or something, or opposing force. Their base is like an airfield inside, inland, and it's huge, massive expanse of terrain, with capture points all along the coast and capture points inland, and I just had so many cool moments in that. One of my favourites was, I was a squad leader, which is my favourite thing to be in that game. Like, it's just the right level of responsibility. Get to boss like 2 or 3 people around, but still have the someone bossing me around, because the commander can give you orders. And I was lying, I was either playing a sniper, playing like a sniper, or actually was a sniper. I think I might have been a medic, but sniping with my assault rifle from the top of one of those massive, gas cylinders, those huge ones. And you can climb up a ladder, it takes like 5 minutes to climb to the top of it. When you climb on the top of it, the sound design in that game is just fucking beautiful, and I'm lying on top of a gas cylinder. Most people don't notice you up there. You're pretty conspicuous if they're looking in a direction, but they don't kind of look for people up there. So I'm kind of looking over the airfield and kind of defending it against attackers. And, it's so quiet. There's just the wind, and you can hear, like, every sound that's happening on the battlefield, you'll hear as a distant echo. Like, you hear the gunshots from the battles going on at the coast. You hear, like, jets buzzing around and, explosions going off in the distance and tanks and stuff. And every now and then a jet will fly directly overhead, and it's a fucking earth-shattering event. Like, your whole room shakes. It's just terrifying. You literally jump out of your skin. And then I'm talking to my squad over the voice comms. Not using real voice comms, but using in-game commands. So I say, like, okay, take this position, or hold this, or, you know, drop ammo here, or that kind of thing, using in-game commands. And you hear their responses coming in over the radio, so there's a little crackle to their voices, because it's coming in your earpiece. And then I don't know, I said something like report in or something generic, and the guy's voice came in without the radio crackle. It was just clear as day right next to my ear. And I knew just from the sound effect on that voice that he had spawned in behind me, because I'm the squad leader and you can spawn the squad leader. And he was now lying on the same gas cylinder with, he was a sniper. And, he just joined me like silently. And, just that kind of the difference in the quality of the sound, depending on whether they're next to you or they're a long way away, is just so perfect. Just like gave that thing a perfect atmosphere. Even though it was a completely surreal event because the guy just teleported.
My favorite maps are probably Counter-Strike, because that's the game I play on multiplayer most. Like, I love the Longest Yard, QTDM17 in Quake 3, and then there's Quake 2 maps I love and stuff. But Counter-Strike's the one I played the most, and I prefer the maps which are imbalanced. Like, that, get that game and its players and its level designers became really obsessed with making sure that it was fair whether you were a terrorist or a counter-terrorist. So dust and that kind of thing is very carefully timed so that both teams arrive at the choke points in the middle of the map at the same time from either side to both give them a fair shot at winning. But I much preferred maps like Assault or Militia, where you had terrorists who were entrenched in a position, and then counter-terrorists that were trying to assault that position, hence the name Assault for that map, because it sold the fantasy of that game of being, you know, a counter-terrorist or a terrorist protecting your hostages in a situation where you're defending yourself. I preferred it when it became about defenders versus attackers rather than just two teams rushing towards each other. CS Mansion, which was cut out of the game for being too unbalanced, was great for that as well. It wasn't a good map, like, from a design point of view, but at the actual experiences you had playing it in terms of Last Stands being the the one person left inside or outside the house trying to save everyone, which is great.
Quite like a lot of the, I have fond memories of a lot of the Half-Life 1 multiplayer maps for the same reason. Like they didn't feel like they were set up to have the kind of flow that multiplayer designed games usually have. And they're full of things that you could just exploit and dominate. So there'd be just a gun turret somewhere and you could just mince people who came out into the yard in one level. They were playful as a result of that. I love them for that. A lot of character to them.
It was the map Crossfire, which had a button in a bunker, which would just call in an airstrike that would kill everyone on the entire map who wasn't inside the bunker when it went off. So you would press this button and like sirens would start to go off. And then after like 5 seconds, the doors on the front of the building would start to very slowly close. So everyone in the level at that point would start fighting their way towards to get under the doors in the last second.
This is crazy guns. Sorry, that's Half-Life 1, right?
Yeah.
They brought it back for Half-Life 2 Deathmatch quite late on. It was like one of the last maps they added before they stopped updating that. But yeah, the same thing where you pressed a button and it called in a nuke and everyone had to get in the doors.
Crazy, such dramatic, fun situations. And it was just a section of the single-player game that had been kind of chopped out and repurposed as a multiplayer map, which is why it was the kind of shonky way it was. But that was the charm of it.
Half-Life 2 Deathmatch. The prison level, which I think might have been the only map when it launched, although maybe there were two, because it was a free
one in the city
update. Yeah. The city one was really good, but the prison one was fucking awesome. And I think I probably still know to this day where every radiator in that whole building is. Because obviously when you're playing with a gravity gun, everything you throw has a different feel to it and a different, like, weight and, how far it goes, how many people it can hit at once, so kind of its bulk and its, all the properties of the way it bounces off things and stuff, and radiators are fucking great. The only thing better than a radiator is a little coiled heating pipe that goes to a radiator that's like sort of a zigzag thing, because it's a little bit thinner than a radiator, so you can slide it under things and you can like skim it across the floor better. And so I just instinctively knew where all of those things were in the map, and as I was like jumping around and jump off a balcony backwards, twist around, pull the radiator out of a prison cell, then flick it at somebody, like all in one motion. So good.
Yeah, I think a lot of my fondness with multiplayer maps is probably a thing, is tied to a thing that is now in the past, which is that a lot of the kind of way you move through multiplayer maps was defined by where the items were. Mm. You don't really get items anymore in a lot of multiplayer games. I think it's a bit of a shame. I quite like that incentive to move through the level and have paths that you weave.
There is, like, even in TF2, there's medkits and ammo kits. And so if you're a scout in particular, you'll learn the location of every medkit on the map because you can get back to it really quickly. And so you skirt in, like get a couple of hits off on the enemy and then run back to the nearest medkit and circle around.
Mm.
So there's some element of memorization like that.
Yeah.
Already, like Grand Bazaar from Battlefield 3.
Hmm.
Because dice level design is about, because there are no pickups in the map apart for a few modes they added in later expansions. So it's all about funneling people into combat zones and then having the combat zone, just the architecture of the thing, be interesting enough to create interesting fights. So Grand Bazaar is built around these incredibly long, very narrow corridors with alcoves dotted along them. And each of the alcoves kind of corresponds to the range of each class's weaponry. So an engineer will be able to kill a guy in the nearest alcove. And then you can also have snipers at the very ends of each of these, just enormous, horrible, grindy death corridors. And you never ever want to go out into them, actually walk physically out into them. You always just want to kind of lie down on the floor and kind of take pot shots and then try and make a run for it. And then, you're trying to advance from alcove to alcove all the time. You're throwing grenades into the alcoves as you move as a squad. So all your squad members will, you'll get together and you say, okay, we're going to go after that one. You'll all leave your alcove, you'll run down the corridor, you'll all throw your grenades exactly the same time into that alcove, wipe out everyone in there until everyone is dead, and then take up positions, and like two of you will die, and if they die in a convenient position, then the medic will revive them and bring you back. Everyone quickly, as soon as you get into the alcove, you throw down ammo, you throw down med packs, and you set up your next control point. And it just sets up these battle lines along these just long crisscrossing corridors that are constantly shifting and makes for just incredibly close and interesting fights. And you also get the Battlefield thing where everything is exploding all the time, and that's always exciting as well.
I love multiplayer maps.
Yeah.
I think I spent most of my teenage years just going to websites where you could download multiplayer maps, just trawling through, like, what was it, File Planet? For yeah, just like every map that was on there, or going to Quake 2 and Quake 3 level community called Level, LVL, which is, you know, rated these things, and just downloading random things and running about them on my own, looking at the architecture and going, oh. Cool. Martin asks, greeting Crate and Crowpar Denters. I recently began full-time employment as an artist in the games industry. Best fucking job ever. And I am naturally sat at an obnoxiously powerful PC for a solid hour every day for lunch. I was wondering what lunchtime games you would recommend for such occasions.
This is the one where I was going to say Supreme Commander Forge Alliance. Because super powerful PC is perfect. It's one of the few games that modern PCs still can, like, there'll still be a difference between a top-of-the-line PC and a mid-range one, even today, in what you can do. And also, like, when I would play at PC Gamer during lunchtime, our lunch break would be an hour, but it would take us like 15 minutes to go and get food, and then we'd usually end up finishing like 10 minutes after lunch break should have finished. And so it does fit into an hour very neatly. It doesn't fit that well into 45 minutes.
As long as you don't sustain yourself or eat or drink or do anything.
Just don't worry about your human needs. that's on like a 20 kilometer by 20 kilometer map with like one or two enemies.
There were quite a few instances where we just paused the game and had it running all afternoon so we could finish it after work. So,
yeah, happy time.
Yeah.
I like the working in the PC Gamer office. It means that everyone has high power PCs around you all the time, which means it's a good excuse to play multiplayer games. And that's kind of what I'd recommend if you're working in a game studio and there's loads of people around you with high power PCs, get some fucking LAN stuff going on, like all the games we mentioned
like
in our previous question.
Yeah.
Just go through those. I'd recommend Left 4 Dead as well, just because I love Left 4 Dead, but four people playing that over lunchtime. Perfect.
Will asks, hello Box and Lever. Hotline Miami is a fantastic game, but it's buggy as all hell. On one level, when I transitioned from one room to another, all the floors and walls disappeared, just leaving the enemies, the blood, and the hypnotic neon background. Wow, I thought, this is pretty trippy. What's the game doing? Being the psychedelic thriller that it is, I was convinced it was intentional until the EXE crashed. Have you ever confused a glitch as part of the game?
Yeah, that's definitely happened in review code. Where, but actually, my answer to the question was going to be that I've confused things in reality for glitches.
That would have been more serious.
Yeah, like I used to do a lot of mapping in the Hammer engine, and I remember when you get the kind of the Hall of Mirrors effect. Which is for a BSP leak, I think it was called. I don't really know what those terms mean, but it was bad.
You didn't put a proper skybox on it. You get that.
Like, it was in the world. Fully contained, didn't it? It was like a space inside them could leak out. So if you didn't have, like, if it wasn't tight, if it wasn't, there wasn't a wall in every direction.
It would infinitely replicate the corners
just
have
this really into the void, and you couldn't render lighting properly because you wouldn't know where the ray should bounce.
Maybe you spent, like, several days solid in the Hammer editor, and then you walk outside and there's light kind of refracting off your glasses. I think, oh, there's a Hall of Mirrors there. Oh, hang on. No, this is the real world.
BSP era.
I had a bug. I didn't mistake it for the way the game was working, but just for a second, I guess my mind did. In Mafia 2, where in a cutscene, all of the vertices of someone's face got randomized. So, like, if you imagine, like, you know, polygons connect the different points on a, like, facial map thing. If you imagine all of those points just being scrambled in space, but they're still linked to each other, so the flesh is stretched between those randomized points. So it's this spiky ball of hideous, distorted flesh with, like, bits of eyeball and bits of, like, the inside of his mouth and, you know, those horrible bits of skull you see on, like, internal textures for a well-rendered face. And just in this disgusting mess, just absolutely repulsive. So for, like, a split second, Mafia 2 turns into the best horror game ever. Just, like, in the middle of a conversation in a diner, one of the gangsters just goes, "Wah!" It's the hideous thing. I actually screamed out loud.
I think I was playing, it was the Game of Thrones game. I was playing it in the office.
The RPG one.
Yeah, terrible RPG one. And somebody came up behind me and was like, is the dog meant to look like that? I was like, yeah, I think the dog's meant to look like that. It's like, you sure it's not just got the, like, a loaded, a lower level detail model? It's just this kind of blurry ball of gristle, basically. Which doesn't even animate properly. It looks like a meatball with kind of chopsticks sticking out the bottom and a horrible kind of minced face. The worst dog in any game ever.
If you haven't already, everyone should see the, GIFs, I think they are, of Dragon Age glitches where people's heads rotate.
Oh, yeah.
It must be something unique to Dragon Age because I haven't seen anywhere else. But
it's good ones in Mass Effect as well, where you go to talk to Ashley in the first cutscene in Mass Effect where you first meet her. She's there, but her head isn't. And then her head is swinging in a giant concentric arc past your vision, moving in giant circles. So it would possibly be fucking odd.
It's a Bioware thing.
It's pretty strange.
In Splinter Cell Double Agent, the one where you pretend to be a terrorist and you go back to the terrorist base between missions, there's a bit where someone who dies in the plot gets, you have to carry them to the morgue and they put them down in their bed. As I was about to get up to leave the room, they just sat up. They just sat bolt upright, like, you know, as if they'd just woken up, but they were still, like, their eyes were shut and it was still just the dead guy model and there was no, like, dialogue or acknowledgement of this in any way. They just sat up and they just stayed sat up and that was it. Jesus Christ.
I feel like a boiling point deserves a shout out.
Oh, yeah.
The most bugged games ever released, probably. There's, like, you just need to read over the patch notes for Boiling Point.
Flying pumas.
Flying pumas were fucking deadly. They could take out helicopters. There's one with, like, firing the crossbow no longer destroys the police station. Two big moon fixed. There are just loads of fantastic, hilarious.
I think patch notes are like the fossils of bugs. Now, fossils are like, they're stuff that leaked into the space where the actual object was. Mm. Like, when you read patch notes, you never get to see the bug that caused them, but you can tell from what they said. Like, okay, fix the size of the moon. The moon was the wrong size before it.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I think there's quite a lot of stuff in Bethesda games which you could easily mistake for bugs, because they basically are, and they just haven't fixed them. Like, you know, when... I remember in Fallout 3, when you... There's a moment early on where you meet the sheriff of, is it Nuketown? I forget the name of it. And my encounter with him was one of the least dramatic things I've ever seen. Because I think he's having an argument with somebody, and then he shoots somebody. Then I walked outside, and he spawned, and he died. And then he stood up again, died again. Then slowly kind of slid down a mountain. And I was instantly accosted by his son, saying, "Have you seen my dad?" I'm like, well, this is probably not how the designers of this mission envisaged this playing out.
Yeah. I don't think that mission broke for me, but it is kind of narratively bullshit. Yeah. It's like he's having a kind of fate in the bar, and I think you can save him or you can not. And I think I tried to save him and failed. And yeah, then his son just walks into the bar and stands astride his father's corpse.
The camera suddenly slams into his face.
Have you seen my dad?
Is he standing over his father's corpse? Creepy. Creepy as fuck. Okay. I think one of your companions can die as well. And throughout, I remember Rich Stanton saying that when he played it, the character not only died, but then he respawned in his kind of modeler pose, like the kind of with arms outstretched and a kind of crucifix, and just floated around after him for the rest of the game.
The exaggerator. I didn't for a second think it was part of the game, but I once had a bug in the Oblivion DLC, Knights of the Nine, where your main contact with the knights is a guy called Thedret, and he's just a sort of generic, like... helper NPC who tells you how the knights work and gets you indoctrinated into them. But for some reason, on my version, he glitched out so that he would always have his arms in a T-shape, like, just spread out. Just whenever... He could still fight and stuff, but every time he was idle, he put his arms back out again. And it just looked like he was saying, like, I just caught a fish this big. But it was completely persistent, so it was just a character trait for him. Like, from then on, no matter how many times I quit the game, reloaded it, disabled mods, put them back in, he would always just, whenever he could, just put his arms out. And, like, because he didn't know he was doing it, he was just looked normal. And if you look at a character in Oblivion, they always look at you, they meet your eyes. So every time I looked at him, like, what are you doing there? He just looked back at me like, what? What are you looking at? What's wrong with you? And I became really attached to him. He could die. But every time he died, I would actually load an old save game to make sure I still had him, because he was the only unique thing in the world. Like, like every other character, even if they're unique within Oblivion, somebody else has that character and they get to, you know, that's just a generic dude who everyone gets. But Dedrick, with his outstretched arms, was uniquely mine. Like, only I have this crazy-ass guy who keeps putting his arms out like this. And so I was, like, being much more attached to him, like, even more than, like, Alex in Half-Life. So I was saying, like, I think I interviewed the lead designer in episode 2, and I was telling him, like, you should just randomize something about Alex. Just everyone's Alex should just be a little bit different. Like, one of them has different eye colors. One of them just smokes for some reason.
one of them floats around with their arms outstretched.
Yeah, one of them has their arms outstretched. Because as soon as you think it's unique to your playthrough, you get much more attached to someone.
Aw. I like the idea that you can get attached to a glitch.
Yeah. He's broken, but he's fine.
It's kind of, like, almost existential. That's something that should appear in a Russian art house film.
Brendan Hale asks, "Hello, Crate and Crowbalachytherium." So, hopefully, he's provided a Wikipedia link. Balachytherium, or Balachytherium, is a gigantic hornless rhino, which used to exist many eons ago. It's a type of megafauna.
Ah, cool.
Which is another
big
cool word.
Creature.
Is it a sign of the singularity or apocalypse that you can make money from buying the Humble Bundle 9 by selling the Steam trading cards from Brutal Legend, Trine 2, and Mark of the Ninja for more than you bought the games for? So basically he's saying that you can buy the game, those three games, through the Humble Bundle so cheaply that you can then play them or run them for a short amount of time, and then the trading cards you get in return are so rare you can sell them in order to make more money than you actually paid for them.
Because you have to pay, if you want to get the Steam keys, you have to pay at least a dollar for the Humble Bundle. But then you've got... I don't think it really matters. I suppose you only ever find half the trading cards for each game, so I guess having three games means you'll have half the trading cards for each game eventually. You do have to play them for a while to get that.
You don't even really have to play them, though. You just leave them running.
Yeah.
Just go to bed at night and leave them on.
Yeah.
While your machine generates you money. I don't think it's a sign of the singularity or the apocalypse. I think it's just Valve are extremely clever and have created a machine for turning everything into money.
I've now bought Steam... it was actually an emoticon I bought for Gunpoint. Because we launched trading cards on it, and then I don't have any of them, and I don't really have time to just play Gunpoint again for another, like, 6 hours in order to get all the trading cards. But I really wanted the emoticon of Conway face palming. And so I looked it up on the Steam Marketplace and found someone who was selling it. The guy who was selling it turned out to be Monolith's community manager. Oh, Salisbury.
Oh, no.
And so I bought it off him for, like, 27 cents or something. This is weird.
Why are you selling this? This should be precious to you.
I think he was, it might have been selling it for slightly more than someone else was selling it. Like, the average price is pretty consistent. And
what is the going rate for that emoticon?
I can't remember. I feel like it was less than a dollar. Some cards are going for like $8 or $9 if they're like a fancy foil. But you can also sell, like, the rewards, because the emoticon is one of the rewards for leveling up your badge, which is the thing you do when you complete the trading set.
Mm.
So you can, like, sell the cards themselves, or you can sell the badges. Not the badges, but the things you get for having the badges. But the cards thing is interesting, isn't it? Because you think, like, why would people pay money for that if you can get all those games for less than a dollar? But then you realize that not everyone who pays a dollar for it is actually going to play the games enough to get those trading cards. So it's really more about just bothering to do it in the first place. And also, even if many people do that, each individual person has an incomplete set. It's hardwired, so you can never get the whole set just by yourself. You have to get them from someone else. And you could trade with them, but that requires some organization.
You don't get the money back out of Steam, do you? Right?
No.
No, it stays in your Steam wallet.
Yeah.
It's a genius way of drawing more people into their system, basically.
Yeah.
No money has been lost, though. You aren't getting something for free. Some other chump has paid for your game. That's what's happened.
Yeah.
If you have bought a full set of trading cards, write in and tell us why. I'd genuinely be interested to know, because I don't...
I bought an emoticon.
Well, yeah, but that's your own game. That's kind of fair.
That's
enough.
Even weird.
I think there are people with a completionist spirit where they see a thing, like a badge that they can earn for earning the maximum number of things from a thing. We've seen this from Xbox Live Arcade, like the point system. People got obsessed about that. People would buy shit games.
Just, for some reason, just imagine like a hardcore game with a tattooed on his arm saying, maximum number of things for a thing.
Yeah, that's what people want. Some people want that. They want the most things they need to get the bigger thing that they want.
With achievements, right? I mean, the word achievement is what sucks people in, right? I mean, the fact that that is attached to some kind of idea of graft or skill is what makes that an attractive number to pursue. I know people exploit it.
Yes.
I know they play games from which it's trivial to get points.
Yeah.
But the idea of getting points is so that it increases your status in some way. And that's because that number is attached to something positive, which is in some level graft. Whereas trading cards, there really is no value. Like, you're not getting them for anything. Like, it's just happening in the background.
But I think that what, you know, free to play stuff Valve has done with Team Fortress 2 and selling chests and things and having item sets in Diablo 3 and that kind of thing, is that people like completing stuff. They like collecting. They really love collecting. They're willing to pay small amounts to collect and complete things. I think it's just for many players, it's a drive that people can cynically exploit for profit.
they're being taxed.
They're being taxed for their...
Their mental disorder is being taxed.
Yeah, it's not normally a disorder until someone taxes it. That's the thing. Just collecting things in games has been a pleasurable thing up until the point at which people have monetized it. Now they're being exploited for their, you know, the way they play games.
Yeah, I do worry that's not a good
training
thing.
Card taps into that, really.
Well, I mean, it's the gamification thing that, was widely touted, about a year or so ago. Where you attach achievements to any kind of activity. Yeah. I imagine you could successfully offer trading cards for people existing and then, you know, create an economy based out of that. What a depressing world that would be if that happened in reality.
You mean that I could buy a Martin trading card and then a Graham trading card and then a Tom trading card and then a Chris and then mine and get like the Creighton Crowbar set, and how much will I pay to get the Quake Robot training?
Well, craft it into a badge and then repeatedly craft those into badges in order to level up your badge so that you can
forever
show off to your peers who are all staring at your Steam.
I'll just be badges. I'll be more badges than man by the end of it. Every square inch is a badge now.
Now we've belittled all the people who do this. There's a related question here from Ankh Watcher. Hello, publicans. I recently realized I could sell all my old TF2 crates for Steam wallet money and credits, and did just that. I was expecting to make about a euro, but it turned out that some of my crates were worth a bit, and I instead raised 7 euros and 47 penny euros?
Mini euros, that makes sense.
Which is about £6 and 31 pence.
I wish they were called mini euros. 1 mini euro, 99 mini euros.
What should he spend it on?
That sounds to me like about the price of gunpoint.
Almost, but he's 68 pence short.
Oh, shit.
Without knowing what he's already got. It's hard to say, isn't it? But
sell one more trading card.
There are loads of games now, certainly on Steam, which cost about that or even less, which are fucking great.
I think Deus Ex is about £3.
Yeah.
Hitman Blood Money is, I don't know if it's always £3, but it's usually around £7 and it regularly gets discounted down to there.
What's the platform that Rich was playing about the cycling family?
Rogue Legacy.
But yeah, how much is that? That's got to be around £6.
Is that about a cycling family?
No. It's like, definitely not cycling.
You die and then you respawn as another member of the family, so there's like cycling.
I see. Right. I don't remember there being any bicycles in that. Yes.
Yeah, it's about,
A
massive tandem bike riding through a dungeon.
GTA is about a cycling family.
This is true. Yeah, there's so many games.
Mm. In fact, I think there's a section on Steam marked £6 or under.
Oh yeah,
I was going to say cycling families.
Yeah, devoted to families on bikes.
Anyway. What, really?
BMX hands one. Sorry.
Harry Tufts asks, "Dear Crate and Crow Baratheons."
Oh, I like that.
Which is topical as well for what he's about to ask. The Game of Thrones mod for Crusader Kings 2 is far better than any of the officially licensed Game of Thrones RPGs, strategy titles, or Facebook games, as we've just discussed, for related to the Gristle Dog. The mechanics and systems of CK2 mesh perfectly with the setting and atmosphere of Game of Thrones. My question, if you could take a game and, through modding, official expansion or otherwise, make that game part of an already established fictional setting or IP, which game and which setting do you think you would go best together? For example, I think Gal Civ 2 would mesh perfectly with the Mass Effect universe.
Yeah, that one. I read that and thought, like, as I was thinking about it, immediately I read his next line as I was thinking about it and thought, oh yeah, no, that's what I want. Galaxy of Mass Effect.
Mm.
I mean, Galaxy of Star Wars as well would be pretty great.
Not entirely. I mean, that could be what... I mean, they said that they're going to have a genre switch with the next...
Probably not a turn-based strategy,
but... No, but I mean, those games are so inclusive. Like, they are becoming these massive snowballs where they just kind of gobble up other genres. That's a really mixed metaphor. Snowballs don't gobble things. Anyway, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was Empire at War, which was a Star Wars game where there was a very high-level, like, galactic strategy map, and then... You moved your resources around on that, like your big fleets, and then if your fleets fought and clashed with some other fleets, you'd go to a real-time 3D space battle. It was sort of functionally 2D, but it looked 3D, where you could like have your bombers target particular weapon systems on the enemy capital ships and then have the fighters defend them. And when you blew up like the left gun of a Star Destroyer, that chunk of the Star Destroyer would be ripped out and have like damage. And then if you wanted to invade a planet, you'd have play out a little ground RTS battle. The ground RTS was shit, and the high-level strategy wasn't great. But the space battles were really good. And it was kind of... It was pretty close to a really awesome thing.
I want Total War and Warhammer to meet.
Which might actually happen.
But Mike, what would you call it?
Who knows? Total Hammer, surely.
Hammer War.
Hammer War, too. Yeah. that is so perfectly suited to the fantasy, Warhammer fantasy universe. The idea of war all the time is exactly what fucking Warhammer is all about. And these, just give CAA a chance to do incredibly varied armies. Like, the way the Orc army operates and on the battlefield is so different to how the High Elves would operate, or, for anyone who's a massive Warhammer nerd like me, it's just gold dust. That magic.
I quite like, this is a bit weird one, but I quite like a James Bond game that worked like Hitman. Like, Hitman's about killing people and it's a bit too bloodthirsty, but you could easily just tweak it a little bit so that your objective is just to steal something, and disguise is still a big part of it, and kind of subterfuge is still a big part of it, and guns are a serious threat, and you have to really think about how you're going to get to your objective.
I think there are so many things that would benefit from being visited as a strategy game. I suppose you could pick up franchises. Like, the thing I always think about is that there's not been a good... police strategy game. Because actually the way that the police operate and the way that they detect crimes is fascinating, and it's very, there's a procedure to be followed, and it involves lots of kind of different resources that you have that intertwine, and, it's the perfect setting for a really rich strategy game, and it's not being explored. So, you know, say The Bill in that case, you know.
I suppose I would go with, Ocean's 11 and Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of combination I want. Heists, but in a world not quite so nihilistic. Vox Vogue asks, how disastrously did Graham's attempt to play Aurora go? I say this as Aurora is probably the single most complex and inaccessible game I've ever had the masochistic pleasure of playing. He's put playing in like square quotes.
Not bad, eh?
And the one who suggested it was probably being mean to you. As is someone who wrote in, because we talked about Dwarf Fortress and these kind of procedurally generated games, like,
wasn't it in fact Hypo-C?
It was indeed. Was it? Yeah.
He wrote in to suggest this game, and I'll finish with the question. Well, I do hope Graham managed to crack through the incredibly vicious interface and the vicious installation process, and the ship design process, and the ship component design process, and judge himself. Well, and then he's attached a screenshot, which obviously we can't show, but I've written out some quotes from it here. And the screenshot's basically just like a single screen showing three different spreadsheets, and each spreadsheet has like four columns.
We can link it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll look at the show notes, but there's some good quotes here, like, through training or experience, Lieutenant Commander Francesca Richardson has increased his fleet movement initiative rating to 137. The political reliability bonus of Colonel Charles Stone has increased to 5%. Unrest is rising on AD Leonis A2 due to overcrowding. Unrest increased by 0.0062%.
You need to send that general to those other places. This is what this spreadsheet is telling you. His political reliability is needed.
Basically, I looked at the wiki for this game and kind of poured through it for about an hour trying to work out what the game was until I found a screenshot. And it looks well, I was going to say it looks amazing. It doesn't look amazing. It sounds amazing in terms of being a grossly complex Dwarf Fortress scale procedurally generated Galsiv game, basically. And it's kind of turn-based, but not really, in as much as it's turn-based, but you can set the increment of time that you're advancing each turn. So if a missile is flying towards one of your fleets, you're micromanaging everything, you might be taking 5 seconds a turn. But if you're sending one of your fleets to travel across the galaxy, you can ramp that up, and so a single turn is actually a week of in-game time. And that sort of thing.
That's pretty cool.
You're kind of managing, like, you start off on a single planet and then you're trying to colonize space and there's warp gates around, and eventually you discover extraterrestrial life, or they discover you and you end up going to war and so forth. So I definitely want to play it, but it's going to take some
commitment.
Yeah, some puffing myself up and,
yeah,
you know,
get stuck into it.
I'm going to have a high level of self-esteem on the day that I tackle this game, because it sounds really cool.
That sounds great.
I just thought of another answer to the previous question. If I want to see Star Wars Mass Effect, Mass Effect just seems like the perfect format for an actual Star Wars game. Like, not like KOTOR, but like, you know, just kind of that level of fidelity and that, like, much better combat and, this sort of, you know, the structure of that, having the ship and the way the companions work just seems perfect.
Also, like, turning those, you know, kind of flaccid Mass Effect bars into Mos Eisley. It's just the perfect way to use the character interaction.
Yeah. By maybe with. Shepard could dance awkwardly in them still.
Yeah. I've thought of another one as well. I would like a God game, because I've been playing Goddess. I played it last week. I was very dissatisfied with it. I would like a God game which was more like a mixture of The Sims and Black and White. So you actually have a pre-existing world which is perhaps largely simulated for you. Maybe, this is quite a big ask, but, you know, all the characters maybe have their own kind of little tasks. Could be very basic to begin with, so it's a little tribe and they're all doing their own things. And you, as a god, need to gain belief in order to become more powerful, as in Goddess, but you do that by manifesting yourself. But to begin with, you're very weak. So the only things you can do are to kind of, like, rustle the branches of a tree and maybe knock things out of a tree so that the Sims below, who are already harvesting the fruits, have an easier time. And if you reward people, like, humankind is naturally kind of given to believing in shit that doesn't exist anyway. So it's you have a kind of base level of belief which exists. But the way you increase belief is by exploiting things like reward or punishment. So when you when you do something like you know, blow a gust of wind across an outcrop, and it causes, through the physics engine, of course, a boulder to land on a citizen. If that citizen has been mean to somebody, or has killed somebody because that's what's going on in this otherwise simulated world, then suddenly that seems like the hand of fate, and people start believing in you more, and you become more powerful, and so your power grows.
But if it's a good person, then they just believe less and just think, ah, random shit happens in this world and it all sucks.
Well, not necessarily. I was thinking that actually this is the black and white element of it. So that you begin to train the civilization based on the moral values that you present them with.
So they always believe God's behind it, but they just learn a different lesson.
Well, they can do. It depends on, you know, if you're completely random in your acts, then yes. They will not increase their belief in you. But if you consistently reward people who are, say, ripping people off for money, or just very successful, wealthy-wise, then the society will become more of a kind of a capitalist one. And if you punish people who do good, then it'll become some kind of horrible satanic monstrosity. Or if you reward good, then it becomes this kind of just civilization. You know, I can imagine that being actually kind of workable.
I like the idea of moulding a society based on a series of surgical doom strikes.
Boulders falling on people 18 times.
You're dropping rocks on people. But I love the idea that you'll in this system, you'd aim with a gust of wind this rock to go down this hill and crush someone, and then it misses and crushes the awesomely charitable giver trying to help that man just right next to him.
You got to decide, do I want to carry on trying to kill mean people and have people not believe in me at all because they just think shit is random, or do I want to actually just go evil and start killing all the good people?
Or just be more subtle, like, how about I don't just blow rocks onto people, how about I just make good harvests where people are good and then bad harvests? Like, there's loads of cool gradations to that kind of.
If somebody's done something which displeases the rest of society, you can just fuck with them, you know? You go around blowing all their shit off counters and things like that, making them...
game ideas that hasn't been made was a suggestion for the Indie Buskers, which was a bunch of indies who would take suggestions in a website suggestion box, and then over a weekend would all like pick one to make, and they never pick us one to make, but someone just said, anonymously, stealth god game. You have to manage your citizens without ever letting them see any evidence of your existence. So you have to make sure no one can prove you exist, but you have to still help them. Because if they see that you're helping them with their harvest, and that if things go wrong, that you'll pick up the slack, they'll just get really complacent. They won't work very hard anymore because they think, oh, God, I'll take care of it. It'll be fine. So you've got to try and help them in ways that no one can actually tell for sure that there was any divine intervention at all.
Well, I think that's all the time we have for our questions from questions.
If you want to write more questions to us next week, you can.
By emailing
at
questions
to emailing to questions at
questionscrowbar.com. Questions at crowbar.com.
That's the worst one we've done so far.
Easily the worst.
You can email us
by looking at the website and finding our email address.
That's wrong. We should
by emailing crittingcrowbar. No?
No.
Questions at crittingcrowbar.com.
Yeah, that one.
One more go.
You can get in touch with us by emailing questions.
We know we're gonna do it. We're gonna. You should just say.
No.
I can just do it.
Just do it.
You can get in touch with us by emailing us at questions@creatingcrowbar.com, or by tweeting us at creatingcrowbar, or by tweeting at us individually. And I am at Gonas, GONNAS.
I am at PCGLudo, and that's LUDO.
I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm at Marsh Davis, which is DABIES.
And then this is the end of the podcast when we say
thanks for listening, everybody.